All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Now we are switching our focus over to the energy sector, oil and natural gas, as we're chatting with Joseph Schachter. Joseph is the founder and editor of the Schachter Energy Report, as well as the Ion Energy Report. That is now on Substack. The Schachter Energy Report really dives a bit more into the companies. Well, Ion Energy looks more broadly at the macro factors driving oil and natural gas. Let's start off with oil then, Joseph, because earlier on this week, even tail end of last week, we were getting a bit of a rebound in the oil price after it had really broke down. But now the rebound came from that $56 level up to the low 60s, $62.40, but looks like it might have topped out here, which would be another lower high. And unfortunately, it does still seem like oil's in a bit of a downtrend. Joseph, talk to us about what drove this rebound and if you think that that's all that the oil price is going to get.
Well, if you remember, we've been talking for a while that I thought the price of oil based on inventory builds and demand being a little sluggish in the U.S. and China, that we were going to go below $60. You know, a couple of weeks ago, we sent on the Friday, you know, a comment to subscribers that we broke $60, but I thought we were going to still go lower. But we were in the 58 range going back a week ago, and then all of a sudden we got the Trump announcement of sanctioning two of the biggest oil producers in Russia that are 5% of global demand, 3-4 million barrels a day between the two of them. No, 5 million between the two of them. The biggest is three, the other is two. And then they popped there was a large amount of retail short positions in the commodity futures. So they were reversing those positions, and that took you to that 62.40. And then all of a sudden, it kind of peaked and sluggish there. And then all of a sudden, people started talking about Russia for 2 years has been able to get around sanctions, and these two big oil companies know how to do that. They can sell to other countries. China's not going to stop buying, but they could find new buyers, or they could, you know, do the transshipment where, you know, they load a cargo from Russia and heads to Indonesia. Indonesia, you know, the tanker might be 3/4 full, put in some Indonesian crude, get it labeled from the Indonesian government that it's Indonesian crude, and then they can sell that to India. So I think in the end, you're going to see no impact on Russian production. It's 9.17 in August. And if you go back to 2024, or the average for the year, it was 9.19. So we're not far off those levels. And I think, you know, you might see a month or two, you know, as everything gets digested and Russia works out the new transshipment points and formats. And once that's done, I think you're going to see the, you know, crude oil back off a little more. And I think we have a chance to, you know, to get to that 56, 57 level, given inventories. We'll get another EIA report, and, you know, a couple more will probably show, you know, demand is sluggish. And, you know, you're just seeing layoffs, Amazon, 13,000 people. And, you're seeing, you know, all of the retail people not hiring for the winter, you know, for the Christmas season, because they're worried about the demand from middle and lower income Americans. So I think that there's a likelihood that we back off a little more. And then the key thing is, we've talked before about our three signals. One is the price of oil, which we wanted it to get below. We thought it would get below 60. It did. And so that was a check mark in favor. Then you had the S&P TSX Energy Index, which is in the 280 range now. We think it's going to go below 240. So there's still a healthy correction there. And then the bullish percentage index was, you know, 87-88% at the high, got down to 40%, bounced to 50 on this on the rally because of the sanctions on the two Russian companies. But I believe as the price of oil backs off here, we'll head down again. Under 10% is a buy signal. Under 5% is a table pounding buy signal. In April of 2025, we got to the lowest level ever recorded at 0%. We were in 2020 at 3.5%, and we were just below 5% in 2008. So, you know, watching an under 10% number is critical for our swinging totally to the bullish side. We've been telling people, hold your cash, hold your cash. You know, we mentioned a couple months ago, and, We're in the 295 range. Maybe take some profits, build up a little more cash, and wait for the next buy signal. And if we get a great buy signal like we did in April, below 5%, I think we're going to be saying go to whatever for each individual based, talk to your investment advisor, see what's appropriate for you. Is oil 10% of your weighting, or is it more or less? People in Alberta might take 25% simply because they're comfortable with the industry, or they have shares in companies that they work for, so that's a part of their net worth. So I think that the next buy signal will be the one where we say it's time to be fully invested.
All right, Joseph. So we'll be watching for those indicators, the price dropping back below 60 again and staying there maybe in the mid-50s, as you say, and those other two indexes reaching the target levels. Then we'll get to those proverbial table-pounding buy moments. But just on circling back to the oil again before we jump into some of the companies, the other factors outside of Russia, do you see anything changing as far as supply-demand coming out of North America with Canada and the U.S. and or anything coming out of the OPEC Plus contingency that you think maybe changes the market setup?
Well, the China numbers are skewed by them building up for their SPR, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. They have like 750 to 800. You can't get a tight number on that. And they want to have 2 billion barrels in their strategic reserve or 60 days of imports. So it's a long way away from that. So they can keep on buying for that, and that's why the Chinese numbers have held in. But the China domestic market utilization is much down because of the consumer problems there. In the United States, you're looking at year-to-date demand 20.3 million barrels compared to 20.17 last year, so it's up 0.8%. But gasoline demand is 8.78 million down from 8.86, so it's down 0.9%. So there's that domestic consumption comment. And we're looking at, a lot of, because of the growing production from, the Permian and the Eagle Ford, the United States is selling that light crude because the refineries in the Gulf Coast and the Chicago area are built for heavier crudes. So the exports last week were 4.2 million barrels. And so the light crudes that are from that, southern part of the U.S. are being exported, and they're bringing in more Canadian heavies, so we're benefiting from it. The one wild card I would mention is if there was a regime change in Venezuela, Maduro gone and the left side of the running the country and the Democratic elected government that won the election, but Maduro changed the ballots and said we won. If there is that reversal of leadership, they could open the door to allow foreign companies, especially U.S., to come in and get their oil production up. And that's an important one because Venezuela was producing 936,000 barrels in August, and they could produce 2 to 3 million barrels, which means they're closer to the United States. And if the American companies are producing it, we may lose some of that market. And that's why I think the issue of TMX and the battle over tolls is going to be needing to be resolved. And then the TMX needs to start planning the expansion. And then remember, we always have rail on top of that. So, I think that the bottom line is Canada needs to find more markets for our heavier crudes, simply because if you believe that at some point Venezuela will change and they open the doors to investment in their, especially their energy industry, then I think the Canadian, producers were going to have new markets. So that's, I think, a pressure point with Carney, where he realized that the Americans are serious about regime change in Venezuela.
Joseph, I know you follow Canada very closely, but I am just curious in terms of your outlook or assessment of U.S. production, because the U.S. is such a key global player in the oil sector with how much production they have. We have seen rig counts continue to broadly decrease, but production has not followed. I understand they're more efficient, they're drilling the maybe easier areas, but do you foresee at all U.S. production ticking down at all?
Well, if you go to last week's EIA data, it was 13.6 million for crude oil and then 10.1 for natural gas, liquids, and renewables. So all in, you're talking, 23.7 million of production. And as I said earlier, demand was only 20. So there's the reason why you're seeing those big exports. The reason I think we're seeing tier one inventory continue to be drilled, the efficiencies you've talked about, and the big players are now are like Exxon, have 1 million barrels, and they're talking about growing production to 2 million. So the big boys are there, and they're going to take a long-term view rather than if you're an independent small producer where you say, look, the money's not there, I'm not going to do it, while an Exxon is thinking, years and years in the future. And so they would be willing to make the investment, even though the price of oil may be low today, but they want to be ready for the markets, longer term. So I think you'll see flat production in 25, 26. And then if we're right that in the second half of 26, we get over 70, maybe over $75 a barrel, that's when I think you're going to start seeing people take a more positive approach and the U.S. production can grow. I'll be watching one company, particularly Freehold Energy Royalty Company. They have a big portion of their production from the United States. So they'll be talking about what's going on and, the drilling that's going on, the production they're getting from those areas. And if you go to Q2, their growth in the production was in the United States. There was not growth in Canada. So we'll be watching both numbers to see if, because they're in the Clearwater and, other areas of the oil side in Canada, if they're not seeing any growth and they see growth in the States, I think it tells you that being involved with the biggest operators, which they are in the U.S. basins, that tells you that you're going to see growth in the U.S. production capacity.
Well, we've talked about oil. Let's shift it over to the cool time of the year and nat gas, where you start seeing that seasonality factor. I guess we can look at the US NYMEX or the Canadian AECO pricing. Any thoughts on nat gas?
Yeah, nat gas, has been trading, 330 to 350. It's backed off a little today, but I think we're looking, as we get into November and the cold weather starts into the, mid part of America and of course across Canada, I think we'll start seeing, US prices getting into the, $4 range and then spike if there's very cold weather and you have more than 200 BCF drawdowns on a weekly basis when you get to the very cold weather. And just watch that Arctic front go down to Texas and you'll see much higher prices. And in Canada, we've recovered, to $1.05, I think, today. But I think, once we get all of the facility stuff that's done and we get back to, the drawdowns, which starts November 1st, I think we'll be looking at $2, $2.50, maybe, late November, December. And then if the cold weather really hits and we have big drawdowns of inventory and we're near full capacity, that's going to be a big help to get the Canadian price up. And I think that's going to be when we start seeing strength. The big thing for the industry in Canada is we need to get LNG Canada running at full capacity, 2 BCF versus 600-700 million a day. They can fill quite a few more tankers if they have the productive both trains working. And if it gets to 2 BCF by June, July, that would be very positive because it would mean they would be drawing gas on a regular basis that might go into storage. And so storage won't fill as fast. And that would be positive for the 26-27 cycle. And I think we could be looking at $3-$4 for AECO, higher prices in the coldest part of winter and lower prices during the shoulder seasons. But a $3 handle for the average for the year would be well received by the industry for AECO.
Joseph, just by outlining those price targets that you have, is there any potential that the natural gas market, either in Canada or in the US, is set up for some sort of explosion higher in price? It just seems to me like the nat gas market has been relatively constrained and kind of boring, actually, for a market that can be much more volatile.
Yeah, I think that the two things will be, the one that everybody always talks about, weather. If it's cold in the United States and the drawdowns are very big, that will be a positive because once you start draining those storage and you have more LNG coming on, you're not going to fill storage as quickly in future years. So that would set up a long-term, very bullish cycle for natural gas in the United States. And in Canada, as I said, if we get LNG at full capacity, they make the decision for a second phase, and that gets pushed through with support of the federal government. And then if we get the other projects moving, wood fiber and Cedar and all the others moving forward, people will see that there could be 6 to 7 BCF of demand by the end of the decade, and the industry is not set up to provide enough to drill and produce that amount of natural gas at the present time, which means number one, you're going to see the industry need higher prices to spend to justify that spend. It takes time to build the facilities, the pipelines, the major facilities for separating the gas from the oil and all the rest of it that you see the industry needing to do. If that's the case, it's gonna set up a very, very bullish cycle for the sector in Canada as well, but behind the United States.
Joseph, in addition to the narratives around weather and the seasonality of natural gas and also the LNG export terminals, both in the US and Canada, the other big story that seems to be gaining ground, I'd love you to weigh in on it, is natural gas for power generation as far as AI data centers. And depending on who we talk to on the show, if we're talking to people in the uranium sector, they're all in on the nuclear, and there's a lot of deals with tech companies in nuclear. If we talk to people in silver, they're big on solar panels and how renewables are going to save the day. But it seems like natural gas is that transition power source for a lot of these AI data centers. Do you think that could be a value driver that's not getting as much airtime, but'll grow over the next year or two?
I think that's that will get the most attention because these small modular nuclear reactors, they're still in the design phase. They don't have anything that's been approved. Nothing has been built. So it's a, late decade opportunity, not, near term 1, 2, 3 years. LNG facilities can be built a lot quicker. The pipeline infrastructure is already in the United States and Canada for it. And what's happening is the companies are being told, we don't want you draining our grid because we don't want home heating, home prices for natural gas to go substantially higher. So we want you to provide your own power for your data centers. And most of them are looking at the natural gas option. And you can just read in, when you see TC Energy report or Enbridge report, you're going to be hearing all more and more about that data center demand, and that these guys will be providing the natural gas to go into those power plants that are going to be both for the normal power providers as well as for the data center people who are going to need a direct supply into their power plants.
All right, Joseph, time to move over to the equities. I want to start off with earnings season. We're still early on for Q3 earnings, but curious what you've seen in terms of the earnings front for either oil or natural gas companies, where again, we were in a very, I would say, price constrained environment for both oil and natural gas. So what are we seeing on the earnings front and what are you expecting?
Well, the only one that's reported so far is Whitecap on the producer side. And in their MD&A, management's discussion and analysis, they show their average WTI price for the quarter, $64.93 versus $75.10. That's US dollars. If you put it in Canadian dollar terms, $89.43 versus $102.43. And then natural gas, if you go to AECO, 63 cents versus 69. So if your volumes are the same, you are going to see, product your cash flows down, your free funds flow down. But if you're, in the other case, they were merging with Veren. So they have a larger production base. And even though they had that larger production base, they still had slower funds flow. I'm just going to pull that up. And the funds flow was less than, it was more in dollar terms, but it was less in terms of percents, per share, simply because of the fact that the prices were lower for the both of those commodities. And that is really the key. You need to have much higher prices for them to really show better numbers. So they did in the quarter 73 cents. And if you go to Q2 of 2025, they did 76 cents. And in 2024, on much lower volumes, they did 69. So when you take into account the greater volumes and the rest of it, they really, on a unit basis, were less profitable than they were, a year ago and in Q2. So the commodity deck coming down shows there. And again, we're going to see a lot more companies report later this week and a big amount next week. And, though that will be the tell for companies, and many of them just focus on keeping production flat, then we're going to see cash flows, free funds flow numbers come down. And then it'll be a question about how much money did they spend for keeping their production flat? And do they, you know, if they had debt, did they pay any of the debt down? A lot of them that have debt have been saying that's their main focus, getting debt down and trying to keep their production flat. And then if they do have a dividend, you know, they have the battle. How much do we pay down debt and can we continue to pay the dividend? And, you know, if we saw a couple quarters here of, you know, sub $60, I think we'd see some companies cutting dividends. But I'm in the optimistic camp that once we get into winter, you know, mid-November through mid-December, I think we'll see oil prices north of 70, and then that'll take the pressure off from having to do something.
Yes, the tug of war between paying down debt and paying dividends, and investors wanting to see those dividends locked in, but companies having to make some hard calls if pricing stays under pressure on the oil price. But you bring up an interesting point with Whitecap about how some companies are using M&A to also build out their future growth or bring down cost or change the dynamics. You had a couple other companies we were talking about off mic that are also in the M&A process right now. So maybe let's talk about mergers and acquisitions and how you see that setting up.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's really a critical one, because in the case of Whitecap, they bought Veren. And so they went from 173,000 BOEs a day in Q3 of 24 to 374,623 in Q3 of 2025. So a big, big number. And for the 9 months, 283,000 versus 173. So a big merger like that, which was for shares, really helped them. We've seen, you know, two more that have happened. Step Energy originally got a $5 bid, you know, from ARC Financial, which has the private equity side that owned a big chunk of it. The minority shareholders, which they needed a big support from, didn't support it. So they came back as, you know, without the takeover. They then, ARC went to those reluctant owners and made a proposal. And the bottom line is they've got a 550 deal. Those minority shareholders have said yes. Management has said yes. So that deal will happen and close, you know, in the next month or so, month or two. And then you've got to the announcement, Kuitno got a bid. ARC was the major shareholder there again. Bid from an American company to buy the company for $24.75. And the stock has popped a couple bucks here on that deal. And the vote for that and the close will be in December. So, you know, if there's companies that are wanting to do strategic deals, the American companies look at the Canadian companies as trading at 50 cents on the dollar versus equivalent American companies. And so they realize there's a big arbitrage benefit for them and a value creation for their shareholders, private equity holders. And so that's why a deal like Kuitno was able to happen.
Joseph, how do you invest around any of these M&A deals? So do they attract you, the end result company? Do you see any opportunities with any of these, or even predicting future M&A deals?
Yeah, I think there's going to be consolidation in a number of areas. So if, you know, if you look at the Montney and Duvernay and stuff like that, and who's on the fairway and who could get taken over. So we own Birchcliff, which we've liked for a long time. And you and I have talked about that many times before. But there's other companies that are in the fairway that would be consolidators. We've seen Tourmaline take over Crew, a company that we used to own. And we thought, again, you're in the right fairway in BC. Consolidation would take you over. You know, you've got Logan Energy, which is on that fairway. So you're going to have many companies that potentially, you know, could get taken over, you know, that could see deals. And I think that, you know, just find the ones that fit your investment thesis and have good balance sheets and don't have debt problems. Some of them don't pay dividends because they're growing faster, like Logan and Kuitno. And so, you know, we've seen the takeover there. In the case of Birchcliff, they're just standing steady, paying down debt, and they're going to start hitting the gas pedal in 2027 and start growing more faster then. And so they would be they have 25 plus, I think over 30 years of reserves. And that's what you need if you want to be a potential takeover by somebody who needs it for LNG exports. So, Birchcliff had a standing room only audience at our conference. And companies that are already very big in the natural gas sector in those areas, like Tourmaline, also had standing rooms. So, you know, again, people know these stocks in the right fairway and have great prospects and upside. And we did see the audience at our conference go to those rooms.
Well, Joseph, M&A also brings up two other interesting angles. One is that companies can decide to diversify their jurisdictions. They may become split between Canada and the U.S., or they may pick a different basin than they're in. And the other thing is the mix of products. Some companies may be more oil heavy and then bring in that nat gas, like you're saying, or some companies may bring in just a nice blend of oil, nat gas, and natural gas liquids. Do you have any thoughts there as far as companies that decide to press their bets in one basin versus switching and diversifying and or bringing in different mix to their product line?
Yeah, if, for example, Whitecap, you know, in Q2, they had 64% liquids. And with the merger of Veren, which had more natural gas, and again, they're building out their natural gas business over time because they want that LNG export capacity. They were 61% liquids in Q3. They could go down to the mid-50s as they build out their Montney and Duvernay. You know, they want the liquids to come off of them and because they're in the right fairway, but they also want to be there as a bigger player on the export market for natural gas. And so I think you'll see more and more companies consider doing that going forward.
All right, Joseph, we're going to wrap it up here. We're out of time for this weekend show, but thanks for diving into the energy sector with us. I feel like we're all just waiting for a more substantial turn here to really bring in some more, I guess, profitable trades within some of these underlying equities. But even at current prices, these companies do seem to be doing okay. But again, that rising price of oil or natural gas can really bring in those investors that a lot of people are still waiting for, a bit more momentum in this sector. Again, Joseph Schachter is the founder and editor of the Schachter Energy Report. You can click the link in the show notes within the posting on our website, podcast, or YouTube channel. And feel free to reach out to us if you want to be put in touch with Joseph for any of his work. Everyone, thanks for tuning in to this weekend show. We hope you all have a great rest of your weekend. And please go back through our website, podcast, YouTube channel, and even Substack page. Just search the KE Report and you can listen to all our daily editorials covering market moves and company updates. Everyone, have a great rest of your weekend.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.